This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Do farm subsidies have a future? Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, the daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Some U.S. farmers say their safety net is being given away. But Argentina and other developing countries say the U.S. and Europe are just playing the same old games. It's all about this week's U.S. offer to cut farm subsidies and make good on a promise to improve world trade. On To the Point, do the big economic powers really intend to give developing countries a break? Is the Bush administration looking to cut the budget by any means necessary? As population and political power shift to cities and suburbs, are farmers losing their clout in Congress? On Reporter's Notebook later on, bankruptcies about to get much harder. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Olney back with To the Point. This week's U.S. offer to cut agricultural subsidies gets mixed reviews from the countries that are supposed to benefit and from American farmers. On To the Point, we'll talk about world trade and political reality. On Reporter's Notebook, America's new bankruptcy law goes into effect on Monday. Will it stop deadbeats from ducking their creditors? What about the victims of natural disaster? First, this news update. Presidential adviser Karl Rove today made his fourth appearance before the grand jury investigating the leak to reporters of a CIA agent's name. White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan said Rove's problems have not disrupted President Bush's agenda.
The president has a great team, and the president is the one who is leading our efforts to address these important priorities, and that's where we're focused, and that's what we will continue to do, is carry out the work of the American people, because that's what they expect. And while there are other things going on, the White House doesn't have time to let those things distract from the important work at hand.
Scott McClellan, just at about the time Karl Rove was leaving the grand jury room, Michael Isikoff is following the story for Newsweek magazine. Michael, always good to have you.
Good to be with you.
He was in there for 4.5 hours. That's a long time.
It is, and to the extent that one can read tea leaves from incomplete data, it's not an encouraging sign for people in the White House or for Karl Rove.
Why do we say that?
Well, the longer he's in there, obviously, the more questions the grand jurors and the prosecutor, Scott Fitzgerald, had. He's already been 3 times before the grand jury. 4 times is an extraordinary number of appearances before a grand jury, and it clearly suggests that there are questions about his prior testimony.
Well, do you have anything to say to reporters when he came out?
He did not.
Nor when he went in.
Nor when he went in. Now, I don't know that I would have expected him to say something, but because, for one thing, he's remains ever the shrewd political operative, and he knows that anything he says would only escalate the story even more. It's already pretty high up, but, it's left most of us to do nothing but speculate. Were he to say anything, it would be footage that would be leading the evening news tonight, and I don't think he wants to lead the evening news.
What about the story? Let's get the background. We have to repeat it every time. It's so complicated. There are 2 reporters that he might or might not have talked to with Time magazine and the New York Times. One, of course, Judith Miller of the New York Times, spent 85 days in jail rather than go before the grand jury. Subsequently,
actually, Warren,
did.
There's no indication he talked to Judith Miller at all. The 2 reporters that we know that he talked to were Matt Cooper of Time magazine,
right.
and Novak, Robert Novak.
Robert Novak, a little man who wasn't there, who hasn't been to the publicly, at least, to the grand jury, but who's the one who actually did print the names.
Right, and I think most people expect that assume at this point that Novak has fully cooperated and provided names and accounts of the conversations he had. It is worth noting that for all the attention this case has gotten, and all the speculation about what happened, there are central pieces that are still missing. And one of them is, who was the primary source for Robert Novak, who triggered this investigation in the first place, who provided the initial information about Valerie Plame, Joe Wilson's wife? A lot of us had thought that it was Scooter Libby, the vice president's chief of staff, mostly by process of elimination and by the direction that Fitzgerald's investigation was going. But 2 weeks ago, when Judy Miller did testify the first time before the grand jury, Mr. Libby's lawyer did talk to reporters for the only time that I'm aware of, or one of the few times on the record, and he was quite explicit about the fact that Mr. Libby had never talked to Robert Novak about this matter. So if he can be believed, it means there is somebody else, not Rove, not Libby, who was the primary source for Novak, and we still don't know who that is.
Again, Michael Isikoff is an investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Thank you for correcting me with regard to Judith Miller and Robert Novak. What do we think it is that, if he wasn't the main source, Rove might have been called back for?
Well, what we think he's been called back for is that, from what we know, there are clear discrepancies between his testimony and Matt Cooper's testimony, the reporter for Time magazine with whom he did talk. There's clear discrepancies between his testimony, or at least what we believe his testimony was, and the Matt Cooper email describing his conversation with Rove. And as we reported this week, there have been shifts in Rove's own account to the grand jury. As we reported, Rove did not initially disclose to the FBI in an initial interview in the fall of 2003 or in his first grand jury appearance that he spoke to Cooper at all. Never mentioned that he'd had any conversation with Matt Cooper about this. Then, as we reported, there was another email that he himself, Rove, had sent to then-Deputy National Security Advisor Steve Hadley right after he spoke with Cooper, saying that he had gotten this call from Matt Cooper about welfare reform, and that Cooper then changed the subject to ask some questions about Niger and the Wilson controversy, and Rove then tells Hadley he set him straight. Well, after Rove's lawyer, Robert Luskin, discovered that email was out there and should have been covered by the subpoenas that the Fitzgerald had sent to the White House, Rove then went back to the grand jury to amend his testimony to account for the fact that he did talk to Cooper, but he described a conversation, apparently, mostly about welfare reform.
Okay, and Cooper says he doesn't remember that. We'll be right back with To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Werman, I'll be back with To the Point, just finishing up with Michael Isikoff of Newsweek magazine. So once again, Matt Cooper says he doesn't remember this welfare conversation, another of the many discrepancies involved in this case. If, in fact, Karl Rove were to be indicted, what would that mean for the Bush political operation?
If Rove gets indicted, it would have a crippling effect on this presidency. He is so central to the operations of the White House, he is so central to Bush's entire political career, that it would be an absolutely devastating blow. I think the stakes in this investigation couldn't be higher. We still don't know the underlying facts, but we do know, I think, two things. One is that if there are no indictments, and that's still a distinct possibility, we just don't know what Fitzgerald's got. If he folds his tent in 2 weeks, and that's when the grand jury expires, he doesn't indict, it really won't matter. I think this whole thing will fizzle and we won't be talking about it in 3 to 6 months. If there are indictments and Rove and Libby, the vice president's chief of staff, is indicted, it would be just an absolutely devastating blow that would have profound repercussions for this entire administration. So, as I said before, the stakes in this one can't be higher.
And as you also said before, we don't know a lot at this point. Michael Isikoff, thanks
a lot.
Always good to talk with you.
Sure enough.
Investigative reporter for Newsweek magazine. 4 years ago in Doha, Qatar, the U.S. and other major world economies promised to reduce tariffs and subsidies that distort free international trade. 2 years ago, 2 years later in Mexico, the second round of Doha talks dissolved in chaos. The last chance for agreement comes in Hong Kong this coming December. And this week, the U.S. Trade Representative Rob Portman announced that the U.S. will cut subsidies by 60% by 2010, if Japan and Europe cut theirs by 80%. Jutta Hennig keeps track of all this as chief editor of the newspaper Inside U.S. Trade. Ms. Hennig, thanks a lot for being with us.
Glad to be here.
How important is this in the history of U.S. farm subsidies and the problems that they have caused other nations around the world? Is this a major change in U.S. policy?
It certainly is an indication that the Bush administration is willing to change a policy. But mind you, this offer was made on the conditions that other major trading partners, another one of the world's large subsidizers, the European Union, would open its market and cut its subsidies as well. It is also made with the understanding that major developing countries like Brazil, India, and China would open their markets. So we don't know what the outcome is, but it certainly was a significant offer and an indication that the Bush administration knows it may have to cut subsidies for its own budgetary reasons. So you may as well make a very ambitious offer in the international talks in an effort to get some credit for that.
So you're saying, in other words, that the reduction of subsidies, which amount to a very large amount of money, might in fact then be necessary because of the budget deficit and all the pressures that there are on the Bush administration to cut spending?
Partially, yes. There is going to be pressure. The United States is scheduled to rewrite its own domestic farm policy in 2007 when current legislation expires, and there are budgetary pressures that are coming to bear. So one way you can leverage that your own domestic situation is, of course, to try to see if you make a very ambitious offer internationally and other countries will match that offer. There's another factor that is stirring the United States to act, which is other countries may challenge the existing subsidies in the World Trade Organization, which kind of functions as an adjudicating body to make sure that that countries stick to existing rules. And in one such case, Brazil has already successfully challenged U.S. Cotton subsidies, and there is no guarantee that other countries will not follow suit. So why not try to use this offer in the Doha talks and at the same time ward off some of your own challenges that you see coming down the pike?
What about the status of the farm community in the Congress? It has always been very special in the United States. There is the romance about the family farm, of course, and also in addition to that, every state has some sort of agricultural interest, which gives the smaller states a big clout in the Senate that they might not have in the House. Is that changing?
It is to some extent, because for the first time, I think, representatives, for example, in the House of the suburban and urban districts outweigh those in the rural district. Nevertheless, like in any other major country, farmers are a powerful political constituency who for some reason seem particularly adept in being able to tap into public purses around the world. So you see in the Congress, there may be a certain shift. There's also a recognition in the Congress of the budgetary pressures that are coming down the pike. At the same time, the Congress would be reluctant to set all tenets of U.S. foreign policy in Geneva. And that is simply because it wants to protect its own power and the right to set foreign policy. I think it may also be helpful to remind you that the subsidies cut that Portman has offered this week in Geneva are only for those subsidies that are particularly linked to production, i.e. I get a check for so and so much money per unit of production of corn or soybeans. The fact that those will be cut doesn't mean that there isn't enough flexibility to support farmers in other ways, maybe with payments for land stewardship. So you mustn't think that these changes that are being advocated would automatically mean an end to all farm subsidies. They just shift subsidies to some extent into areas where they're not so much distorting production. This is what the European Union has done in 2003 with its reforms of the common agricultural policy. If you were very casual, you'd certainly say lots of farmers there get checks for looking cute in overalls. So
we're going to hear from people who represent farmers with different points of view, with or without overalls, in just a moment. But first, back to the question of Congress. Saxby Chambliss, who's chair of the Agricultural Committee, I believe, in the U.S. Senate.
Yes, he is.
Is one of the seven top recipients of farm lobby money, I should say. That's not surprising given his position in that committee. But isn't it true also that members of Congress, in fact, in many cases, are farmers and get farm subsidies?
Yes, but I think that's less. I mean, I have not. I actually can't speak to that in detail. But I think it's more the constituent
okay.
Pressure. And as you said, there's the romance with a family farm. When in reality, when you check and analyze who gets the majority of U.S. farm payments, 75% of farm subsidies go to very large farms. So on some level, there is also a disconnect between reality and myth.
All
you
right.
know, and agricultural self-sufficiency. And it seemed, you know, what we need to remember about the events in Geneva this week, in a way it was like a big public relations effort between the U.S. and the European Union, because both of them wanted to demonstrate that they are willing to try to revive these lagging Doha negotiations. And the U.S. made its offer conditional on the EU and others opening their market and cutting their subsidies. EU also floated ideas for cutting import tariffs. Mind you, it was only done by the two commissioners, not really in close consultation with the member states. So there is some political tension there. And when you do that in front of all the world's radio reporters and TV cameras, you are trying to revive the negotiations, but you're also putting yourself in a very good position to blame the other guy if you don't reach your goal of reviving the negotiation, because here you were for all the world to see, to show how ambitious you were willing to be if only the other guy had pulled along. So this is also, on some level, a way to set each other up to be able to do some finger pointing should Hong Kong fail to produce the desired result. Now, Hong Kong does not mark the end of these negotiations. Instead, it is meant to finally reach agreement on exactly how much farm subsidies will be cut and how much tariffs will be cut. This is done, of course, by a very complicated formula, and it will take at least another year following the ministerial in Hong Kong in 2005 to complete the negotiation.
All right. As I indicated, we're going to hear in a moment from farmers on different sides of this issue here in the United States. But first, since you've raised this question so cogently about the United States and Europe and their public positions in all of this, let me go to Michael Mann, who is the spokesperson for the European Commission for Agriculture and Rural Development, based in Brussels. Michael Mann, you've been listening carefully, and thanks for being with us.
That's a pleasure. Nice to be on the program.
Are the U.S. and Europe jockeying for position and making a way for the possibility of doing some finger-pointing in December if the talks fail at that point?
That was a rather skeptical, cynical view, I think, of what we're doing, to be quite honest. I mean, you know, we don't do these things lightly. I mean, basically, we are trying to – there's only 8 or 9 weeks now until Hong Kong. Has been a lot of sort of shadow boxing until now. What we are both trying to do, I think, is to try and inject real life into these talks and actually get a result. I mean, it's really rather premature to be talking about blame games and finger-pointing and so forth. I mean, we are serious here. I mean, we realize not only that this is a very important thing for ourselves, for our own industries, and for prosperity in the European Union. But, I mean, this thing is actually called, this round of negotiations, is called the Doha Development Agenda, and it's all about trying to help the third world out of poverty as well. So it would be rather cynical of us just to sort of be going through the motions and pretending that we're trying to do some good, when in fact there is real economic benefits at stake here. You know, we're talking about reports from the World Bank that say that global wealth could be increased enormously if these talks lead to a successful conclusion. That's not just us who are going to gain from that, but it's also the developing countries as well.
Well, what about the United States' condition? We'll reduce subsidies by 60% if Europe, also Japan, reduces subsidies by 80%. Is this a just and reasonable proposal?
We've said all along, because, I mean, we basically have a different approach to reforming our farm policy to that of the United States. What we have done, as Jutta very carefully explained before, is that we have actually reformed our common agricultural policy ahead of the talks, our plan being to lock in our reforms in whatever agreement comes out of Hong Kong, whereas the US approach has been more to negotiate in Hong Kong and then see afterwards what changes it has to make to its farm policy, in a way, just to oversimplify it a little bit. Now, we have shifted our policy away from payments linked to what farmers produce, which are the most trade-distorting, most damaging payments for world commodity prices. Now, and again, Jutta's description was quaint, but not quite accurate. I mean, we pay farmers income support payments, but they are, they have to, in return for getting these payments, maintain very, very strict land management standards. They have to maintain the environment in good condition. They have to maintain animal welfare, food quality standards. So there are a number of very strict criteria. Now, this has allowed us, because, as Jutta also explained, we're not talking about cutting overall farm spending necessarily. We're talking about the trade damaging effects of farm spending. So we have shifted our spending away from trade damaging spending into more environmental measures and so forth, and land husbandry and so forth. And that will allow us to go further than the United States has offered to go in cutting distorting domestic subsidies to farmers. We've also promised to phase out all our export subsidies. That's a promise we've made. But again, we need parallel concessions from the US side and from all the other partners as well, who use different sorts of export subsidization but nonetheless do subsidize their exports. And likewise on market access, we realize that we are going to have to open our markets to more imports from abroad. That's something we're committed to. But again, a point that Jutta made, I mean, we are the European Commission negotiating on behalf of 25 countries, sovereign countries, and so we obviously have to keep in mind very carefully the concerns of those countries. We are staying within the mandate they've given us, but we obviously have to keep a look over our shoulders to make sure we're not overstepping the mark.
Okay, Michael Mann, again with the European Commission for Agriculture and Rural Development. Back to Jutta Hennig of Inside U.S. Trade. I want to defend your comments against the charge of cynicism.
Actually, just to clarify, I did. I'm not a cynic, but it doesn't take too much imagination to see that these factors can be in play. But as I had said originally, clearly it was an effort to try to dislodge these talks that have been stalled for years now over the issue of agriculture, even though they cover much more than that. They cover trade in goods and services. So, no, I was not suggesting that this is the overarching motivation, but as I said, it doesn't take too much imagination to see that that is certainly okay. A possibility.
All right. As I indicated, we will be back in a moment, and we'll hear from two American farm organizations with different views about what we're talking about here and what the impact might be on farmers in the United States. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, bankruptcy is about to get much harder. We'll hear about the new law that goes into effect on Monday, and we're told lines are forming around bankruptcy courts all over the United States today by people who want to get in their filings before the new law goes into effect. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Trust
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the so-called Doha round of trade talks, international trade talks, begun in Doha, Qatar in 2001, had a very unsuccessful session in Mexico 2 years ago, and now another is upcoming in Hong Kong in December. In advance of that, as we've just heard, the U.S. and the European Union are talking about reductions of subsidies, agricultural subsidies, which are intended to improve world trade for the developing nations, as we just heard from Michael Mann of the European Commission, could in fact increase international wealth enormously if in fact this works. Let's take a look now at the domestic implications of all of this. Some farm groups are saying that the trade negotiators for the United States are giving away a lot of the safety net for American farmers and getting nothing in return. One of those is Tom Bias, who's Vice President of Government Relations for the National Farmers Union, represents about 250,000 farmers. Tom Bias, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Why do you say that this is giving away the safety net?
Well, because if you look at what Mr. Portman outlined last week...
Rob Portman, the trade representative. Go ahead.
Right, Rob Portman, the trade representative. It definitely is going to impact our domestic farm policy, which was carefully crafted in 2002 to provide an adequate safety net for U.S. farmers when circumstances beyond their control warranted. It was a counter-cyclical safety net. The payments only... are made to farmers if they're needed. For example, if prices are higher, payments, the assistance kicks in. If we get a decent price from the marketplace, where every farmer wants to get his price, by the way, prices are lower. So it was a counter-cyclical effort. It followed 5 years of the most disastrous farm program ever, which is sort of what they're proposing at the WTO round, this decoupled farm safety net, where it has no relevancy to what a producer is farming today, what they're producing today, or what economic or weather circumstances they face today. We tried it in the United States. It was called Freedom to Farm. It didn't work. It ended up being the most costly. And our farmers don't want to go back to that system. They like the current counter-cyclical safety net.
This is all enormously complicated for a lot of listeners, I think, who aren't familiar with it in great detail. When you talk about decoupling and so on, elaborate a little bit on what you mean, if you will, so people can better understand how you believe it is that farmers, many of them at least, will be worse off if, in fact, the new policy goes into effect.
Well, first of all, again, farmers want to get their price from the marketplace. I don't care if that's here or wherever in the world. And they deserve a profit on their hard work and effort. But our farm programs are based upon, our safety nets based upon the circumstances that they face. It's pretty tough to justify paying a farmer based on what they did 20 years ago or what their yield was 20 years ago as a safety net for situations that they face today. That's a decoupled payment, has no connection whatsoever to production agriculture, what's going on out here. And that also, I think, is demeaning to farmers to do that. Second thing is, if the safety net is not adequate, and it's based on what you did in the past and not what situations you face in the future or present, then Congress and domestic lawmakers are going to step in and help their constituencies. And every nation has that sovereign right to try to benefit their constituents, especially in the production of food and fiber, which is so necessary for everyone.
Why should farmers get this kind of support for government, particularly from an administration dedicated to the idea of the free market? Other industries don't get this kind of support.
Well, Congress writes the domestic farm policy, usually not the administration. And a good example of that was the last farm bill.
Well, there's a Congress that's dedicated to free market policies, too.
Well, they are. A lot of our policies, and here's the problem. A lot of people like to pick on the European Union and the United States on their subsidies. Ours are just more transparent than other countries. The OECD has estimated that about $1 billion a day, $360 billion worldwide, is spent on some sort of schemes to prop up agriculture. Some countries use transparent methods, like the United States. It's very upfront. Everybody knows it. And oftentimes we get a big target on our back for that. But if you look at the overall amount being spent in the world, we're less than $20 billion out of that $360 billion. Europe is probably around 80 or less. So other countries are doing different schemes to protect their farmers. We think the trade round is flawed because, number one, they're not negotiating all the factors of trade. The United States, our competition in international markets is not so much the developed countries, but developing countries that have a tremendous economic advantage in cost of production because of cheap labor, lax environmental standards, and sometimes a manipulation of currency.
We just heard Michael Mann from the European Commission say environmental standards and other kinds of standards are going to be increased.
Well, this is not being required by the WTO. We're not negotiating labor standards. And let's just take an example of what happened recently here in Congress when we debated the Central America Free Trade Agreement. Sugar was a very controversial issue because the United States has higher sugar prices than many of the sugar-producing countries around the world. Well, the difference is our price is so high is we don't pay our workers a dollar a day here in the United States. They get a decent wage, and we also have environmental standards and health and safety standards that our society has deemed important for the production of agriculture in the United States. Our competition, those people who want to sell into our market or into the international market, should have to meet the same standards. And so if you're ever going to have this proverbial level playing field, you can't have it without bringing labor, environment, health, safety, and currency issues into the fight. And the Doha round doesn't do that. It talks about domestic subsidies, export subsidies, and market access.
Tom Bias, Vice President, Government Relations for the National Farmers Union, again representing about 250,000 farmers. Blake Hurst is Vice President of the Missouri Farm Bureau. He's also a contributing writer to the American Enterprise Institute magazine. He himself grows corn, soybeans, and greenhouse plants in Missouri. And Blake Hurst, we're glad to have you with us.
Well, it's good to be here.
You have been quoted as saying that you don't think that in all good conscience the United States can continue to have such high subsidies as it has now. So are you then in favor of what Rob Portman is proposing?
Yeah, I think it's a step forward that will be beneficial for U.S. agriculture. I want to point out before we go any further that I am wearing my overalls today, and I do look quite fetching.
We're glad to hear that on both counts.
But it is, I think, a step forward in the trade agreements or the trade negotiations. It's important that we use what leverage we have to try to get as good a deal for American agriculture as we can. We're faced with, and I think it's important, and Mr. Bias made a very good point, pointing out the difference in the subsidies between the EU and the United States. And it's important that we're asking them to cut more than we are cutting, because that will get their subsidy level to just twice ours instead of four times ours, and that's what we're asking for.
Well, why is it you say that the subsidies are too high now in the United States and we can't in any good conscience continue that?
Oh, and again, that would be speaking, you know, as myself, not necessarily
speaking
for Farm Bureau, but I'm a little uncomfortable with the level of subsidies in the final Farm Bill. I think the last Farm Bill, the 2000. Free Farm Bill, I think they were quite generous, and as Mr. Bias says, he's exactly correct. Farmers are very happy with the Farm Bill. But it causes problems. The Kansas City Federal Reserve Board did a study that said land prices started increasing with the signing of the last Farm Bill long before it went into effect, because farmers and investors realized that it was going to be very lucrative for agriculture. So we have a tendency to bid those subsidies directly into the price of land, which then increases the cost of production, makes us less competitive, makes it harder for young farmers to get involved in farming, and ends up, too much subsidy ends up being a cost to all of our farmers and making us less competitive. So it's a very fine line we have to walk.
What about this question of labor and environmental standards?
I think that it is going to be very presumptuous of us to require countries that have been slower to develop than we have to adopt our standards. 50 years ago, we didn't have the standards we do now. I'm glad that we have them now, but it is a little bit arrogant and presumptuous of us to require those of other countries that are in the process, in the stage of development that maybe we were 50 or 100 years ago. Sure, we want to be very careful that anything we import in the United States, any food we import in the United States, is produced in a safe manner. But I believe that our competitors are quite able to set their own environmental labor and wage standards, and I don't believe it's any of our business.
Well, Mr. Bias said a moment ago, though, that the so-called developing countries, in fact, have what he referred to as schemes to prop up their agriculture that end up not being very visible, but to the tune of a great deal more in the way of a total billions of dollars spent than the United States and Europe.
I think Mr. Bias was most of the big dollars in farm subsidies are spent by the United States, by Europe, and by Japan. I think it'd be pretty hard to argue that third world countries are spending a lot of money protecting their agriculture. No doubt there are tariff protections that keep our products from being imported into some of the third world countries that would appreciate and would improve the standard of living of those folks if they could buy my soybeans that I'm combining today. And if that's the point he's making, then I agree with it totally. But the only way we can get them to reduce their subsidies or reduce their tariffs, their barriers to trade, is if we do the same.
Okay. Blake Hurst again with the Missouri Farm Bureau. Let me go back to Tom Bias with the National Farmers Union. First, on the first question raised here, that if the subsidies are too generous, as Blake Hurst describes them, then it ultimately ends up raising the cost of production. It's counterproductive.
Well, I can appreciate Mr. Hurst's comments, although I would think if you polled most farmers, I don't think they would say they're too lucrative. The safety net is not designed to make farmers whole. It's to help them when the market fails. And the marketplace fails any time a farmer cannot get a decent return out of the marketplace. I go back. It's all about trade. And Mr. Hurst said that he thought it might be a little arrogant for the United States to tell other countries how to treat their labor and their environment. Well, if it's okay for the WTO to dictate how we're going to farm and design our farm policies in the United States, I think it's reasonable for us to demonstrate the leadership that we want to lift these countries' economic development, and a decent livable wage is one way to do it. We have to compete. In the United States, about a quarter of our cost of production in the aggregate is because of labor, environmental, health, and safety standards. So let's just take Brazil, for example. When we compete with them on producing soybeans, and I believe Mr. Hurst is out combining soybeans today, they produce soybeans down there. Their land's very similar to ours. Their climate's very similar. They have the technology. In fact, they have the technology that we have here in the United States on Roundup Ready products, but they don't pay the tech fee. In the United States, it's about $15 per acre for a producer. So if you have 1,000 acres, you can do the math. It's quite a bit of money.
Okay. Obviously, there's a lot of disagreement here about terms like a decent return, what's generous, what's competitive, what's lucrative, and plenty of room for a disagreement on those issues. I want to go back to Blake Hurst quickly on one point because we're running short of time, and that is it true that the WTO, the World Trade Organization, is dictating American farm policy? Isn't, as Saxby Chambliss, the chair of the Senate Ag Committee, said, isn't it Congress that writes the farm bill?
Well, sure, it's Congress who writes the farm bill, and any requirements that the WTO makes on us is because we signed an agreement that said we would abide by their rules. And if they adjudicate the case and decide that we haven't abided by the rules, then we have to change the way we are doing our policy. Now, they're not writing the farm bill. There's lots of flexibility in how we meet the WTO's requirements. But, yes, we have agreed with them that we will give a little bit of power away in order that other countries might cut their tariffs. And And it's a bargain that I think serves agriculture well.
All right. I want to squeeze in one more guest before we run out of time here. David Orden, who's Senior Research Fellow in Markets, Trade, and Institutions Division of the International Food Policy Research Institute, which is based in Washington. And David Orden, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Sorry we have so little time left. But respond, if you will, to what we've heard about the practices of the so-called developing countries here, and particularly with regard to China and India as so-called developing countries.
Well, okay, let me just draw a contrast between the $360 billion a year spent on subsidies in the wealthier countries and the 350 million poor farm households throughout the developing world. And that's quite a contrast. These are households often living on less than $1 or $2 a day per person. So our research shows that the developing countries have a great deal to gain from more liberal trade in agricultural products, reduction of subsidies and tariffs. And they have that to gain for two reasons. One, because of the burden put on them in limited market access from the developed countries because of the subsidies and high tariffs. And then secondly, they impose some burdens on each other with their own high tariffs against agricultural products. So both of those are areas where reform is needed if we're going to get a more orderly sort of system of agricultural trade and bring the benefits we could see to developing countries, which often have a comparative advantage in agriculture.
What about this question of labor costs and environmental and labor and safety standards?
Well, farmers in every country complain that farmers in the other country have some advantage they don't have. In the United States and other developed countries, we've got excellent highways, we've got excellent port facilities, the electricity works all the time, we've got skilled laborers. In developing countries, have different types of advantages. You have low-cost labor. You may not have as strong environmental standards, but you also have roads that are in bad shape. You have electricity that might only come on 2 hours a day. You've got weak port facilities and bad administration that doesn't makes it costly to ship products. So there's just an unending list of ways that farmers in one country can compare themselves on indirect impacts of what advantages and disadvantages they have. In the trade negotiations, the crucial part is, what about these subsidies and tariffs? That's really the policy is directly focused on agriculture that the trade negotiations are all about. And in that context, compared to what others have said, you don't have to be skeptical to think, to recognize there's no knight on a beautiful horse riding into the Geneva negotiations to save the day. Each country's proposal is somewhat self-serving in terms of what's put into it. In the U.S. case, for example, the U.S. proposal is very nice and strong on reducing tariffs in the world, and our research shows that reducing tariffs would be a very important part of improving the agricultural access for developing countries. But the U.S. proposal is not as strong as other countries are asking on reducing U.S. subsidies. It sounds like a big cut, 60%, but we're talking about a cut in what's allowed. We're talking about bringing a cap down to about $21 or $22 billion. Well, last year we only spent $13 billion, so that cap wouldn't even be binding. The base for that cap is the years 1999 to 2001, and those are the three highest years of farm program spending since 1990. So there is a little sleight of hand in each country's proposal. The same is true of the Europeans' proposal. They don't want to cut tariffs very much, and yet they say they want to help the developing countries. So you have to look carefully at these numbers and recognize that even some big-sounding numbers may not mean that much
okay.
in reality.
David Orden, again, with the International Food Policy Research Institute. Very quickly, Michael Mann of the European Commission. We've only got about 30 seconds left. I understand you wanted to make a final point.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about development. I mean, if you look at the European Union, we actually have a thing called the Everything But Arms Agreement, which will basically give completely free access to the European market for all products, free of tariffs, free of quotas for the 50 poorest countries in the world. We already import farm produce, as much farm produce from the developing world as the US, Japan, Australia, Canada, New Zealand put together. So, you know, if we're talking about market access and tariffs, we're not doing such a bad job, I wouldn't say, at the moment. And you know, we're very serious about getting this agreement done. Also, I just wanted to make a small point
on the
amount of money that's spent. I mean, we have to bear in mind we have 11 million farmers in the European Union, and in the US they have, I think, 2 million. So there is a slight you have to be careful when you look at statistics sometimes.
All right. Obviously, a very complicated subject. Some background before the next round, which will occur in Hong Kong in December. We'll talk more about it between now and then, and hope all of you will be able to join us again. Michael Mann, again, with the European Commission. David Orden, with the International Food Policy Research Institute. Blake Hurst, of the Missouri Farm Bureau. Tom Bias, of the National Farmers Union. And Jutta Hedig, Chief Editor of Inside U.S. Trade. Thanks again to all of you. Bankruptcy filings have risen dramatically in advance of the new law scheduled to take effect Monday. Lines form today at courthouses around the country. Miami's bankruptcy court clerk will be open on Sunday in order to give procrastinators a final chance to beat the deadline. How tough is the new law? Will hurricane victims be given a break? More in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Werman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Banking and credit card companies campaigned and lobbied to get the new bankruptcy law that goes into effect on Monday. The targets were said to be wild spenders who went bankrupt to duck their creditors when the bills came due. But a forthcoming study for the Nevada Law Journal shows that bankruptcies rise most rapidly in states hit by natural disasters, and that the filings come 2 or 3 years after the disasters themselves. Professor Robert Lawless wrote the report. Professor, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What do those things lead you to conclude about bankruptcy in the United States?
Well, it leads me to conclude that that the main problem is not consumer overspending, but that people run into problems that they didn't foresee and are major crises in their lives that lead to a bankruptcy filing.
This fact that they don't file until a couple of years after the disasters happen, does that suggest that they're trying to stay out of bankruptcy court?
Yeah, I think it does. The findings in the paper are consistent with everything else we know about the reasons people file for bankruptcy, that people don't file for bankruptcy the day after they get laid off. There's always been, in the academic literature, a lag between the onset of problems and the actual bankruptcy filing.
What does this say, then, about the arguments that were used to pass the bankruptcy law, which was passed by a big margin in the Congress, signed, of course, into effect by President Bush in April?
Well, I don't think anyone actually studies this stuff actually thought the arguments were factually correct. The arguments, of course, were that the bankruptcy courts are full of overspending consumers, and study after study after study has shown that that's just simply not the case, that the amount of abuse is very small, that most people file bankruptcy for one of three reasons, which is divorce, some type of job loss, or some type of health problem.
How much more difficult will this new bankruptcy law make it for people who file for those reasons?
Well, I think it's going to make it a lot more difficult for people to file bankruptcy. It's one of the things the proponents of the law say is, well, you can still file bankruptcy, and I guess at one level that's true, but you're more likely to get thrown out of the bankruptcy court to have your case dismissed.
So the rules are tougher.
The rules are much tougher. We're going to have to there are just so many ways it's going to affect consumers. Consumers are going to have to file or go through consumer credit counseling before they get into bankruptcy court. There's a story in the New York Times today about many of those credit counseling agencies possibly losing their tax-exempt status, which could lead to a problem of not being able to find credit counseling agencies. But that's your ticket into bankruptcy court here in the future. There's going to be an income test, what's been called a means test, to see if you really deserve the bankruptcy relief that you've applied for, as to whether you have to be in Chapter 7, the more traditional type of bankruptcy, or Chapter 13, which is a repayment plan. I think there are going to be new rules that are going in for attorneys. It's going to make it consumer bankruptcy attorneys do more work and take more risk, and simple supply and demand tells you that it's going to be more costly to find a consumer bankruptcy attorney, and I think more difficult to find one, period. Many of our my students at my school are losing interest in a career in the bankruptcy area because of this new law.
Robert Lawless, professor of law at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas. So you don't seem to have a lot of sympathy in this instance with the banks and the credit card companies.
This bill is special interest legislation, pure and simple. It's been in progress for 8 years. Millions of dollars in campaign contributions came from the consumer finance industry, and it's you know, I guess the end result, given that kind of pressure and that kind of lobbying, is not surprising. You know, I don't think anybody objects to the notion that people ought to pay as much as they can to their creditors. But this bill does nothing to accomplish that. It's kind of like closing the hospital and declaring that you've cured cancer. We're still going to have lots of with this bankruptcy law, you're still going to have lots of people with lots of financial problems.
Back to the question of natural disaster, the senator from Louisiana, Democrat Mary Landrieu, tried to get a bill passed that would postpone at least some of these new provisions that you're talking about for areas that were hit by Katrina and Rita. That bill seems to be dead on arrival. Would it have helped? And what do you think special problems are that are faced by those survivors of those hurricanes?
Yes, I think that law would have helped and would have helped a lot, and it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. The Bush administration's own Department of Justice the Department of Justice has some role in all bankruptcy proceedings, and they announced that they weren't going to enforce provisions of this new law. They weren't going to show up in bankruptcy court and object to the hurricane victims and filing bankruptcy petitions. But, of course, the Bush administration's statement's not binding on private creditors, but they made exactly the right move. We need to have some relief in the bankruptcy law for these victims of natural disasters, and you know, hopefully Congress will act.
But if they don't, then people are relying on the kindness of creditors.
That's right. That's exactly right. If people trust to rely on the kindness of the credit card companies and the consumer finance industry, then we'll be fine. But you know, I guess based upon past history, I'm a little skeptical that'll be forthcoming.
So a recent poll indicating that people in those areas say the worst thing that happened to them was they lost everything. That was the largest number of people who testified. Do you expect the credit card companies and the banks to announce any different, any new policies in this regard?
Well, some have. Some credit card companies and some lenders have been responsible and announced payment or repayment plans, or you call us. But it's not very clear exactly what the scope of that has been. They say in the news that if people call them, they'll give some relief. But no one is for sure as to exactly what that relief will be.
Robert Lawless, thanks very much for being with us.
Happy to do it.
Professor of Law, University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Producers of To the Point, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Ileana Justice, Jonah King, Sharon Rimbaum. Managing producer Karen Radziner. Thanks to the John Coltrane family. Technical director Mike Newport. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production, KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.